Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Thursday, April 8th. Thank you, everyone, for your patience in waiting for us. The House was convened in a session until shortly before 1 o'clock, and we needed just a few minutes of transition time to get from the House chamber to offices and to set up this hearing for today. Before we start, will you please call the roll?
There we go. Representative Levy.
Present by video.
Representative Marsh. She's excused. Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. We have a.
This is Rep Marsh. I'm sorry I wasn't here when my name was called, but I'm here now. Thank you.
Thanks. Glad you are joining us right at the beginning here. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2379. And as LRO is getting ready to introduce this for us, I want to thank all of the witnesses who are participating in today's hearing, and especially appreciate it that you have your microphones muted and your cameras off. As you are called to testify, then of course, please do turn the camera on and the mic on. We will be having to step in a lively way through this hearing. And some of the usual courtesies and niceties, you may feel that it's just we're trying to move things through a little more quickly because we'd like to hear from as many people as possible today. After Legislative Revenue Office presents the bill for us, we have the sponsor of the bill to present for us for 25 minutes. There will be a 23-minute warning bell, so you know you're 2 minutes away from concluding. The first presenter gets 25 minutes. The second group of two presenters gets 25 minutes to present their point of view and information. Following that, we move to the list of witnesses. And when we're ready to do that, I will call several names in advance, at least, so that you can be preparing to be called on. LRO.
Karen Nathanson, members of the committee. This is Jamie McGovern for the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2379. We spoke yesterday about the Forest Products Harvest Tax. This would repeal the Forest Products Harvest Tax and establish a new tax based on value and establishes funds. There's a dash six that's also posted. The dash six reworks the bill, which essentially has this value tax that increases based on the size of land ownership. And then the correlating funds are established for the purpose of the money that's collected in this tax and also use of those funds.
Thank you. Our first witness, Representative Paul Holvey, please.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Members of the committee, for the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8. Thank you for having this hearing on a very complex issue and a little bit controversial, perhaps. I know that there's a lot of angst over this proposal, but I would like to walk through a little bit of this, and I hope that I have some slides that are available that I brought forward. Yes. So we've all, many of us, of course, have seen all the articles from OPB and the Oregonian about timber taxation. This issue has been an issue I've been working on for, I think, since 2013, when I introduced our first bill on trying to raise more money through the forest harvest products tax to fight forest fires. I was very concerned that we are resource poor in trying to match Mother Nature and forest fires. And as years go by, it seems that it is getting worse and not better. So there's been a lot of articles about many aspects of the timber industry, the taxation, and what it's meant to communities. So I would like to go to the next slide, please. And committee, you may have seen a couple of these slides before, versions of them, so I won't spend a lot of time on them. I think you've seen this one, though. This one goes back a little further, but not as far forward as the one you've seen, I believe. But it does show that back in the 90s, we had a pretty robust severance tax. And this tax essentially disappeared. In Measure 5, 50, and 47 all happened as well in this time frame. And of course, the federal timber harvest went away. But what is really clear here is that we had the property tax and the harvest tax, and we essentially lost that severance tax, which mostly went to counties for education and public safety and some other things. So I just wanted to make sure that folks saw this, because this is sort of the reason I brought this bill forward, was trying to figure out the taxation on forest lands and how we could better fund our agency and the uses that are under the forest harvest products tax mostly, including fire funding, which is one of the purposes, I believe, of this tax or policies for the state of Oregon, is to suppress fire largely. So I believe that it is a really imperative that you etch this in your mind, because it used to be part of that taxation system. And it was really disturbing to me over the years, because in my 17 years in the legislature, for 15 years of them, I was told by industry lobbyists that the timber industry paid half of the fire costs across the board. And I kept seeing these rising increases in our budgets going out for fire costs, and kept wondering whether or not that 50% was keeping current. And so I endeavored to do a little research and asked our legislative offices to look into this. And it's complicated, because it involves both expenditures on the fiscal side and revenue coming in on the other side of this as well. So next slide, please. And I will recognize, that you've seen this as well. And this is essentially the harvest where you see the federal lands disappearing around that same time, but really is a separate chart than the one that shows the severance taxes going away as well. Though it had a little impact for sure, but absent are those severance taxes going forward. And you can see the harvest remains fairly consistent through since that time, the middle 90s, I guess. Next slide, please. So, and this graph sort of shows how that severance tax was phased out. It's, I think, a little bit mislabeled here, but a lot of people use privilege taxes interchangeable with severance taxes, and so it does get a little confusing sometimes. But you can see that the tax in Western Oregon and Eastern Oregon were a little bit different, I think, to make up for the value difference between lands on the east side and west side and their productivity. So you can definitely see those are real dollar revenues that are disappearing. And at the same time, the counties were losing this money. Education was shifted to be mostly a responsibility of the state, who picked that up without really a replacement of this revenue stream. So next slide, please. Oh, we skipped one. There we go. And so this slide shows the forest products harvest tax, and perhaps you've seen this one before, but it does show how that harvest tax is divided up into different categories. You have Oregon State University Research and Education. You've got the protection fund, which is the firefighting portion of it. And then you have a separate bucket for the forest practices, and then for OFRI on the end, the Oregon Forest Resource or Research Institute. So I think it's really imperative that you look to see that it is pretty stagnant when it comes, especially to the protection fund. That has not gone up, and there's reasons for that. But in a time when we are seeing increasing costs, it is a little baffling to see this fire protection fund staying stagnant when we know we have big fire seasons in front of us. Well, at the same time, they're putting more money into some of the other buckets, not that the Forest Practices Act doesn't need more money, but also the Oregon Forest, the OFRI bucket also increased actually last cycle whilst, the fire portion of it remained stagnant. So it does call in the question that when you look at this, renewing this particular bill, which I think you heard about yesterday, they don't really give you an opportunity as the revenue committee, I believe, to say, well, maybe we should put more over here or more over here, more over there. And is this really where we need to focus, to meet the mission or the purpose of the state of Oregon's policy to suppress fire? So it seems like it's not really the main focus of this tax anymore, and maybe hasn't been for quite some time. So I just wanted to point that out, that some of those reasons are in the statutes that make up the expenditure side of fighting fire, but also the revenue side. There's a cap on how much can be expended from this fund, so it doesn't really change much, which leaves the general fund exposed to all the increases that go forward in rising fire costs. So next slide, please. I do want to also point out that this is an important slide to consider, and I think it is part of the crux that sort of made me start wondering about the equitable distribution or allocation of those fire costs. When we talk about these fire costs, we're generally in our budget talking about the ODF protected lands. And when you look at the ownership of those lands, you'll see that 77% of those lands are owned privately, and the other 23% are a variety of publics. So that's just an important item to keep in mind. When I've been told over the years that it was 50-50, I'm going, well, nah, the land ownership certainly isn't 50-50. So next slide, please. And this does show, going back to 2013, a comparison between the general fund expenditure for fire expenditures and what's coming out of the Forest Land Protection Fund going forward. And so you can see that that $13.5 million cap sort of keeps the Forest Land Protection the Forest Land Protection Fund pretty constant. And any sort of fluctuation in fire seasons is really borne by the general fund. Like it is, for practical purposes, the insurance policy that the state of Oregon income taxpayers pay the premiums on. So next slide, please. And so in our analysis that we did with the data that we have access to, through the Department of Revenue, really. We broke up to see what the total fire funding was and what percentage was paid. And this is an average for 5 years from 2013 to 2018. And it is pretty consistent year to year, but it fluctuates a little bit. But you can see our general fund making up 36%, and federal funds making up 31%. Because when we contract to do fire suppression on federal lands, they actually pay 100% of those fire costs. And so you can also see that the private side is at 22% in this particular pie chart. So I will have some caveats to this a little bit later in my presentation, but thought it important to recognize that when the private owns 77% of the land, they're paying about 22% or 23%. So next slide, please. So when I was looking at this, it came to light that, how this distribution or allocation of fire costs was being treated in Oregon. I thought, well, how does Washington deal with these fire costs? And so we did a comparison on the fire costs and how those taxes work. Including both the severance or privilege and property taxes, and then compared that to the state of Washington. And you can see those comparisons here. And I would note at the bottom, you can look at, the comparison of tax dollars per acre, tax dollars per board foot by volume, and then also tax dollars by value. And in all of those columns, you can see that that the taxes are substantially higher in the state of Washington. And I'm sure you'll hear, most states pay their fire costs out of the general fund, which is true, they do, but what's not reflected is that they also have their severance tax goes into their general fund, whereas ours goes to different buckets that we saw earlier. It doesn't go through the general fund. So that is a little nuance that I think needs to be paid attention to. But this is an important chart, and I think that it's something to keep in mind. Is one of the things that sort of alarmed me. And so when I proposed House Bill 2379, it was based on trying to bring a value tax to Oregon instead of a tax on volume, and trying to, because we share the same sort of timber marketplace as such with the state of Washington. So thought it'd be a good comparison and tried to make sure we were as close to apples as we can, having to convert from excise tax system to a tax on volume. And so this is what we came up with. So there are some things that aren't included in this, and that's something that will probably come up too, is what's relevant to be in that that tax comparison, because we have an income tax, the state of Washington doesn't generally, and in fact, on the other hand, the state of Washington has a B&O tax or a sales tax that Oregon doesn't. So when I looked at comparing those two, I didn't think they were really relevant to fire costs or to in relationship to the forest harvest products tax. So, and the reason is I didn't think that, but even if I did, I do notice that in the state of Washington, in addition to their severance tax of $32,600,000 from 2017 figures, they also had a B&O tax of $32 million and a little bit of change from the industry as well. So that sort of cancels out, I would call it, the income tax. So I think that, I have admitted that there are some issues with these figures. It probably doesn't adequately compare in-kind contributions, for example. And we did have a lot of trouble finding out information on assessments as well. So, and then trying to compare that to the state of Washington on their assessments and their income contributions. Next slide, please. So in light of that, I think in 2019, after I was before this committee before, and there was quite a bit of back and forth, and my numbers were not received well. I was told that I was making stuff up and that I was using alternative facts, which was a little aggravating for me because I was getting my facts from the Department of Revenue. But some folks in the industry came to me and said, you've got some great points, but the industry doesn't really believe your figures. And I acknowledge, my figures may not be complete. There may be more data. So we agreed to do an independent fire cost study, and that was put in place by House Bill 4304. And, unfortunately, it didn't get contracted out by DAS in a very prompt way, so the compression time of getting that study done is getting turned in a little bit late, but should be forthcoming soon. So it's really important that we be able to take that extra input data and make sure we look at this. But just in relationship to this bill, when people look at this bill is a proposal based on what it would look like if it was similar to the state of Washington. I recognize that these figures in this bill may not be exactly right and deserve further input. And so, the one point that I will probably make that the industry would probably agree with is, this bill is not ready to move forward with the current numbers because it needs further analysis, and those numbers are likely to change. But I did want to recognize, what I had and those uses that are funding and trying to figure out a way to move this to a volume tax. I think that, or not a volume tax, but a tax on value and away from the volume. And the reason for some of that is that we have some very large timberland owners who are, their business entities, I guess, are structured in as like in trust lands or real estate investment trusts and timber industry management organizations that don't pay income tax directly to the state of Oregon, and perhaps very little indirectly because they are pass-throughs and their shareholders will pay taxes, but largely most of those shareholders are on Wall Street, hedge funds and investment portfolios that invest in these companies, and most of which probably do not live in the state of Oregon. And so the income tax from those types of organizations are not realized, and so it makes it very inequitable for the smaller landowners who do pay the income tax. So, it seemed like a big disparity. And, I just don't see a way Oregon achieves a more equitable tax structure without moving to a value-based severance tax as opposed to a volume-based harvest tax. I will be looking forward to that, and I hope the committee gets this from staff as soon as it comes in so that they can take a look at that study, to help, help the industry and some of the rest of us who are questioning, the fairness of that particular tax to come to be able to have a conversation with common data. So next slide, please. So now we get to the House Bill 2379 with the Dash 6 amendment, and I'm just going to walk through this. This bill does replace the harvest tax completely, and it does eliminate funding for OFRI. And so, I know a little bit of heartburn, but You know, we became real concerned with OFRI as they appear to be operating with tax money and doing things that I wouldn't normally think they would. You know, when they were trying to affect legislation and also looking at, there's some testimony from Dr. Beverly Law on another bill that perhaps you've seen, but her testimony is you know pretty critical of OFRI and their efforts to push back and kind of squash the study on emissions, which impacted the discussion in the legislature and put pressure on the Oregon State University. You know, really trying to discredit that particular study. And so that's of great concern. And the other part of it was, is that, you know, we also noticed that a lot of people in Oregon aren't seeing that. And we find that through that tax that most of that harvest tax, more of that harvest tax is going to OFRI, which seems to operate more like a public relations firm, putting ads on TV, you know, talking about the Forest Practices Act and how, you know, we deliver the cleanest water. And that, you know, that really hasn't been the experience of many communities that have been suffering with water quality because of forest practices, or even with the EPA and NOAA in the coastal zone management area, where we have been out of compliance because of forestry practices in our coastal streams, which impacts our ability to get grants as well as we get penalties from the federal government on that aspect. So it is with that lens that I don't really think it's appropriate that OFRI be funded with through a public tax. And so the bill does implement a severance tax, as I said, and it creates a wildfire management fund. And it does repeal the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund as a result, so that, you know, we're not taxing two different systems. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. There we go. So the bill starts out trying to recognize, and you know, people ask me, well, where'd you get these figures? Where'd you get these numbers? And you know, the idea really is not that these numbers may not be exact, they may not be perfect, and they will most likely need to be changed with more input data. But this is based on, you know, what I described as the bill trying to come closer to what the state of Washington does, because we're in the same competitive marketplace, you know, with industries. Matter of fact, we export a lot of a lot of Washington and Oregon logs out of Longview. So for owners of 100 acres or less, I've got the severance tax set at 2%, and then it goes up, you can see, incrementally from 100 acres to a section of land a square mile, then goes in at 3%, and then for 6 square miles, it goes up to 3840, and that will be at 4%. And then above that 3840, it goes in at 5%. Additionally, there's an ability for any of the forest landowners who receive forest stewardship certification to reduce that tax by 1% across the board. This bill also includes the exemption for 25,000 board feet of annual harvest as well, which is consistent with the Forest Products Harvest Tax. Next slide, please. And so when I want to talk about the uses of where these dollars go, you will see, as soon as that slide comes up, that 40% of this newly created severance tax will go to the Wild Management Fund for wildfire suppression, mitigation, or prevention within the Department of Forestry. Along with that, recognizing the loss to counties from the disappearance of that severance tax in the early 90s, we've got 30% of the new severance tax going to counties for general fund use. In addition, we have 10% going to the Forest Practices Act, as you can read, 5% to the HEC or for Oregon State Universities for their education. And included in this new bucket will be a directive to Oregon State University to work on and include outreach programs in coordination for K-12 schools on forestry education, recognizing that the industry saw a value in that under the OFRI model. Again, a new portion of this tax going back to local government, 7.5% to rural fire protection districts. This, I think, is we really need to beef up our resources, as we can see from the catastrophic fires we've had and communities basically burning to the ground, and some of our fire districts burning to the ground as well. And then also to recognize, you know, a lot of input that 7.5% go to Watershed Enhancement Board restoration and for water quality and habitat conservation, as many communities have suffered impacts, whether from, you know, water quality issues largely. Next slide, please.
Representative Holvey, that was the 25-minute bell.
Oh, was it? Okay. Well, that sums it up, I guess. And like I said, Chair Nathanson, thank you very much. I hope you have an opportunity to look this over closely and compare the data as it comes in. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have a presentation, 25 minutes. Chris Edwards and Mr. Edwards, I think you are sharing this presentation with Tyler Ernst. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me having some technical difficulties. Okay, are you ready?
We're ready, and just go in whatever order you prefer, but remember to introduce yourselves.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reschke, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. OFIC is a trade association representing manufacturers and large landowners in Oregon's forest sector. I'm joined today by Tyler Ernst, Policy Counsel for Manufacturing and Resources at OFIC. To begin, I just sincerely want to thank you, Chair Nathanson, for giving us a reasonable amount of time to share information and our perspective on what is fairly complex tax policy. We have not been afforded really much more than a couple of minutes in previous hearings. And it's really, you know, it's a complex topic that that deserves more time consideration. So we really do, we thank you. Now, we're proud of what we do and how we do it. We're proud that we manage our lands for the long term, generation to generation. We're proud that we provide 60,000 family wage jobs here in Oregon. And we're proud that we provide long-term carbon storage solutions in the building materials grown on our lands. But, you know, we do recognize that there are fundamental differences in perspectives on how private forest lands ought to be managed. And I think, you know, if all the stakeholders of this debate were honest, for some proponents of the bill, and I'm not saying all, and I'm not ascribing motivation to the sponsor of the bill, but for some folks that have jumped on this bandwagon, it's really motivated by disagreements about forest management practices. And, you know, we just need to remember that despite some fundamental disagreements, the signatories of the Private Forest Accord MOU, both on the environmental and the landowner side, are at the table together following the science to try and find common ground on controversial issues. And that's where the conversation is happening. We need to be looking to the future, to what is possible, and this desire to reignite the timber wars of the past using taxation as the drip torch to touch off that blaze, just, it's frankly not productive for Oregon, and it doesn't move us forward. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tyler, who's going to share some tax information, and then I'll be back with some concluding remarks after his presentation. Tyler?
Well, good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Spam, and Reschke, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tyler Ernst. And I want to echo what Chris said. I'm excited to be here today. Honestly, I am. We've been champing at the bit to share our story on timber taxation. And it's a privilege to be in front of the committee to share that story today. So I'm going to frame my presentation today through the lens of tax fairness. That's kind of been the narrative that has driven this conversation in recent months. And so I am going to attempt to answer this question is the timber industry taxed fairly in Oregon? And I'm going to attempt to answer that question by looking at three comparisons. First, I'm going to compare the tax that's paid by private forest land owners under the state's property tax system to the tax that's paid by other landowners. Second, I'm going to compare the total tax burden, not just property taxes, but the total tax burden on the industry to the tax burden on other businesses in the state as a share of GDP. And third, I'm going to compare the amount that private landowners contribute to state fire funding to amounts that private landowners contribute to fire funding in other Western states. So I'm going to start, however, if you'll advance to the next slide, with just a little bit of background. Now, if you've lived in Oregon for any amount of time at all, you know there are a lot of forests in Oregon. Back one slide, please. There we go. And those forests, 30 million acres, roughly half of the land base of Oregon, are divided fairly evenly between three management classifications. You have timber production, you have multi-resource lands, so that would be a combination of recreational, resource protection, commercial, and then you have reserve lands, and these are your wilderness lands. Well, today we're going to be focusing on that light blue slice of the pie there, the lands that are being managed for timber production. And most of those, 34 of that 36%, are private lands. They're owned by private landowners, large and small. And so when we talk about this first question, this question of property tax, we're really talking about that segment of the forest lands in Oregon. And I just want to note, too, we like to toot our own horn a little bit, but those roughly 10 million acres that are used for timber production, those are really productive acres. If you go to the next slide, we are the nation's number one producer of softwood lumber and plywood, and I believe mass timber too, although maybe don't quote me on that one. So if you go now to the next slide, let's get to the topic at hand, and that tax policy. So when we talk about property tax, that first inquiry, you have to realize that Oregon's forest land program is really predicated on four foundational principles. First, that Measure 5 and Measure 47/50, which I'll just refer to as Measure 50 going forward, apply to all real property in the state, regardless of the land use category. Second, severance taxes are for the extraction of non-renewable resources, and flowing from that, timber is not a non-renewable resource. In fact, number three, timber is more akin to a crop. And then finally, the tax code should not encourage the conversion and development of our working lands. So if you'll advance to the next slide, I think to get at that first point, that first foundational principle, I need to return to some of the history that was discussed yesterday by LFO in that great presentation. But I really want to key in on three key policy changes and considerations right there in the middle of the screen that really led to the forest land program that we have today. So in the decades prior to 1990, standing timber in Oregon on private lands was taxed as real property. And that tax wasn't collected annually like it was on other land. Instead, it was collected when that timber was harvested through a severance tax. Well, in 1990, you had a seismic shift in tax policy in the state of Oregon when Oregon voters passed ballot measure 5. And of course, ballot measure 5 limited the maximum allowable tax rate among all taxing districts to 1.5%. Well, this directly conflicted with the existing timber tax program, since timber was being treated as real property, that severance tax was subject to the limits of ballot measure 5. And so the legislature was met with a conundrum. They had to restructure the tax on timberland. And as they were deliberating how to do that, another consideration came into that discussion, which was this consideration of should timber continue to be considered real property when it's grown on private forest lands. And the reason why that was in question was because the fundamental nature of forests on private forest lands had changed in those intervening decades since the severance tax was first implemented. The timber that was being harvested from private lands was no longer old growth timber. It was second or third growth timber. And so there was this debate about should timber continue to be considered real property or should it be viewed as more of a crop? And that was ultimately the viewpoint that won out, and I'm going to return to that in a second. So what happened then was the legislature framed this new program, which eliminated standing timber from the tax rolls. It eliminated that property tax on standing timber, and instead it implemented what I refer to as the 80-20 program. So only the underlying land was taxed, only the underlying timberland was taxed, but to make the carrying cost, or to reduce the carrying cost, I should say, of that land, that land was only taxed at 20% of its assessable value. And that 80% that was essentially deferred year after year was then collected when the timber was harvested from that land through a privilege tax. And so the amount that was collected, though, in the end, based on the rate that was set for that privilege tax, was supposed to essentially break even on if the land had been taxed every year at 100% of its taxable value. Well, then there was another shift in tax policy in the state when ballot measure 47 was passed. And although ballot measure 47/50 did a few different things, the one that I really want to focus on is that it set a cap on the maximum rate of growth of assessable value for property in the state. Well, this presented a problem with this new timberland program because there wasn't a cap on how much timber values or how much log values could grow. And so conceivably, you could have a scenario where the growth of that privilege tax outpaced that cap, that capped 3% growth of the land. And since the privilege tax, again, was just supposed to make up for that 80% of taxable value that wasn't collected year after year, you would all of a sudden have a program where timberlands were not actually being subject to the same limitations as all other land in the state imposed by ballot measure 50. And so the 80-20 program was eliminated, and tax on 100% of the value of the timberland, or the maximum specially assessed value, was phased in, and the privilege tax was phased out. So what's the take-home message? The take-home message is that the forest land program that we have today treats private timberland in Oregon just like other property in Oregon is treated, subject to the limits of ballot measure 5 and ballot measure 50. So if you go to the next slide, the next consideration, and really the consideration that led to the legislature deciding to no longer tax timber as real property, was this consideration of the nature of severance taxes. Severance taxes are for the severance of non-renewable resources from land, and trees are, by their very nature, renewable. If you harvest a tree, you can plant a new one in its place. And in fact, under Oregon law, under the Forest Practices Act, private landowners have to replant all the acres that they harvest. And so trees are not like minerals. They're not like oil and gas that's permanently severed from land. And this really led, next slide, into the next consideration, was that timber is really more akin to a crop, especially since now we're dealing with, on private timberland, second, third, or even fourth growth now. The landowner has to put in that upfront cost of replanting all those acres when they're harvested. They have additional capital expenditures over the first number of years that new stand is being established. And then they have to incur the incredible carrying costs over decades until that timber is mature, and then they can finally see a monetary return from that new stand. But we like to say that timber is actually so much more than a crop, because during those intervening decades before that new stand is matured and is ready to harvest, those lands produce all kinds of attendant benefits. The State Department of Environmental Quality has found that our working timberlands produce the highest water quality of any competing land use in the state. Those lands also provide for recreational opportunities, wildlife habitat, and they provide the economic and the social backbone of many of the rural communities in this state. Next slide, please. So this is what led to this fourth determination, this fourth pillar, if you will, of the Forest Land Program, because of all of those benefits, economic and non-economic, that working timberlands provide, one of the goals of our land use laws in this state is to preserve working forest lands as working forest lands. And there was a recognition by the legislature in the 90s that our land use laws and our tax laws work together to accomplish that goal. If you raise the tax liability on one class of land too high, you will incentivize, you will encourage conversion of that land to other uses. So if you go to the next slide, our system works really well in Oregon. We have preserved in our state a far higher percentage of our timberlands than our neighbors to the north and the south. And it's because of these policy decisions. So if you go to the next slide. So the take home message again from this first question is yes, private forest land owners are treated equitably. In fact, the forest land program that's in place today was put in place to preserve equity, to preserve parity in the system by treating timberland owners just like the owners of any other kind of real property. But that's only part of the analysis. You know, one of the frustrating things to us in these conversations over the last number of months and really years is the way that property taxes have been singled out and have been considered in a vacuum. But if you're talking about tax fairness, shouldn't you look at the total tax burden that's shouldered by an industry? There are all these other taxes. You see kind of a list of the major tax categories here on the slide. And frankly, we didn't have a great answer to this question. We had never done the analysis to try to derive this total tax burden and to compare that to other industries in the state. And so at the end of last year, we commissioned Ernst & Young to complete a study to try to derive this aggregate tax burden for the industry. And if you'll go to the next slide, at the conclusion of their study, this is what they found. I'm going to wait until this slide comes up. Nope. There we go. They found that the Oregon forest industry pays over 1.5 times what all other Oregon businesses pay in terms of a total tax burden as a share of GDP, 1.5 times. So if you are talking about a total tax burden and tax fairness, I would say that the Oregon forest industry pays more than its fair share of taxes, more than its fair share towards the operations of this state. So you might say, well, okay, but so much of this conversation has been predicated on fire funding. And indeed, if you look at this graph here, you see that a not insignificant portion of the forest industry's total tax burden comes in the form of fire assessments. And so, you know, there's still a question out there. Well, do private landowners pay their fair share of fire assessment? Do they pay their fair share toward the state's fire costs? Well, you can't really compare, obviously, the timber industry to other industries to get at this question of fairness in fire funding, because no other business category in this state directly pays for fire costs the way that the timber industry does. Go to the next slide, please. So here we had to look across state lines. And of course, Representative Holvey mentioned the study that's being completed. We eagerly anticipate the outcome of that study. But we decided to jump the gun a little bit and do our own preliminary analysis of that. Before I get to that, however, I want you to go to the next slide. And I want to say a word about the various ways that private landowners contribute to fire funding in this state. Much was made about this 62-cent assessment that's part of the forest products harvest tax and how it's been stagnant for a number of years. But this is only one bucket. This is only one of a number of different revenue streams that come from private landowners to fund firefighting in this state. In fact, as you see here, that only accounts for $2.25 million of around $30 million that the industry contributes for fire funding in the state. And the reason why that is stagnant is because that piece funds these fixed costs, these severity costs, as you see over on the side there to the left of your screen, items 2 through 6. These are fixed costs. And so they're fairly predictable for the industry. And so that rate has remained relatively stagnant. But this does not mean that the overall amount that the industry contributes to fire funding has remained stagnant. Anything but, if you look at the last item there in that middle column, this is the assessment, this is the contribution from the industry that pays for the industry share of fire protection on private lands. And this is that 50-50 split that we talk about. The industry is responsible for 50% of the costs of the base fire costs on private lands. And that amount has grown over the last number of years. If you will go to the next slide, you'll see here, this is the total amount of base fire costs to the state. And as you can see, it's grown between 4% and 5% every year. And since the industry share of this is a fixed percent, not a fixed amount, it has grown at the same rate. And so it is just patently false to say that the industry's, that the amount that the industry has paid has remained stagnant. It has grown as the cost to the state of base fire funding has grown as well. So that's just kind of an aside on how fire funding works and how private landowners contribute to fire funding in the state. But that leaves the question outstanding, doesn't it? Is the amount that the industry is contributing to fire funding fair? So go to the next slide. Well, our preliminary analysis based on publicly available data shows that when you look at other Western states, yes, Oregon landowners pay far more than private landowners in any other Western state to fire funding. And if you look at the closest analog, Washington, Oregon forest land owners pay close to three times as much towards fire funding on an aggregate basis as private landowners in Washington. If you look at that on a per acre basis, it's still more than two times as much. So our answer to that question would be yes, absolutely. Oregon forest landowners pay their fair share towards fire funding in the state. Now, if you go to the next slide, I want to talk briefly about what House Bill 2379 will do. We've done some preliminary calculations, and at a 5% severance tax rate, House Bill 2379 would raise $140 million in harvest tax revenue. $140 million. And this is based on fairly conservative estimates of current log prices. That means that this bill would effectively double the total tax burden borne by the industry. If you talk about that in terms of tax burden as a share of GDP, which we asked Ernst & Young to derive, that would mean that the forest industry would essentially pay close to three times as much as other Oregon businesses as a share of GDP. Now, look, I know very few people that aren't moved by the concept of fairness. But when you consider this analysis and when you consider these facts, this starts to look a lot less like a quest for fairness and a lot more like a punitive measure that is intended to damage or to disadvantage an industry that, yes, raises very strong feelings in people across the state, but that is a bedrock industry for many of our rural communities that provides valuable, even invaluable, environmental and social and material goods and services to the state and the citizens of the state, and that, yes, pays its fair share, I would say more than its fair share, towards the ongoing operations of the state. If there is anything, if there is any unfair article before the committee today, I would argue it is House Bill 2379. Now I'll kick it back over to Chris for the last few minutes of our presentation.
Thanks, Tyler. And Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, and Vice Chair Reschke, members of the committee, I think that you can see from the information presented by Tyler that the forest sector already pays substantially more than other sectors. And this effort to double the taxes paid by the sector comes on the heels of the worst fires in our state's modern history. The Labor Day fires of 2020 destroyed 400,000 acres of private forest land. 400,000 acres, that's a lot of land. And it's worth noting that the timber that was destroyed in those wildfires was not insured. You can't insure trees against destruction from wildfire. So astronomical costs are being incurred to rehabilitate and replant the lands that were destroyed. Costs for clearing the burned and charred trees to create space for planting new seedlings so the sunlight can get down on them. Oh, and by the way, a lot of the trees, you know, thousands of acres, are too young and too small to cut 2x4s or 2x6s from, you know, if they're 5, 10, 15 years old. So there's not a value to be to help offset the cost for clearing those trees. It's just pure costs. And then there's the cost of overseeding the burnt landscapes with native seed to mitigate against soil erosion and provide feed and habitat for critters. There's the cost of replacing thousands of culverts that were destroyed by the fires. And there's the cost of replanting at about $1,000 an acre. At $1,000 an acre times 400,000 acres lost, that's over $400 million. I mean, this catastrophic loss warrants a helping hand, not a punch in the gut, but doubling the sector's taxes right now. I mean, how could that feel like anything but a punch in the gut? Landowners don't want to dwell on the timber wars of the past. They've been looking to the future. They're looking for common ground, whether that's in the private forest accord that's ongoing right now, collaborating on wildfire resilience bills this legislative session. And now this committee has a decision to make whether to continue to stoke the flames of yesterday's timber wars or look collaboratively to the future as we try to get these landscapes and communities that depend on them back on their feet. So again, Chair Nathanson, I sincerely thank you for giving us a reasonable amount of time to share our perspective and information on this critical threat to our sector and the thousands of livelihoods that would be impacted by it. Thank you.
Thank you both for the presentation. For people who are used to seeing hearings where we then have questions from the committee and discussion, I'm going to ask the committee to hold their questions or any issues that are arising for them until our next meeting. I want to be sure that we hear from as many people today as possible who have signed up for this. For this public hearing to present their information and their comments and ideas to us. So to the presenters who've spoken already, thank you. And we are ready to move to our remaining witness list. I want to announce how this is going to proceed. We have an awful lot of people, more than we can accommodate at 3 minutes each. I'm going to ask anyone from an agency who has a neutral comment or presentation for us to keep it to just 2 minutes. I will appreciate that. Of course, anyone who's with us today is welcome to submit written testimony. You have 24 hours from the time of the start, published time of the meeting time today. You have 24 hours to submit written comments. So agency people with neutral comments, could you limit it to 2 minutes each? Everyone else, we're going to start with 3 minutes each for at least the first handful of witnesses. We'll see how many we can get through. And then at some point, I will shift to 2 minutes each. And I hope that that will suffice for an amount of time for you to get your point across to us. And again, you can submit written testimony as well. The first speaker will be Sage Shiratori. That will be followed by John Sweet, then David Bugney, then Michael Calhoun. Sage Shiratori, please.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nathanson, committee members, Sage Shiratori, Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. In the interest of time, I will not reiterate what I said on the bill as introduced or the -3 amendments in my February 25th testimony before House Agriculture and Natural Resources. We have no position on the bill, but I will just say thank you to Representative Holvey for taking those considerations into concern in the -6 amendment. The -6 amendment raises two implementation questions for us. One is, if the forest products harvest tax is repealed on January 1st, 2022, we want to be real clear that we would still, as a department, be collecting on FPHT that for timber harvested in 2021, even in 2022. Second point is the tiered rate structure based on land ownership is a mixing of apples and oranges. It's a legislative policy decision, but the tax is on the owner of the timber at the time of harvest. And there are many times when that harvester, that timber owner, may own no land whatsoever, particularly if they're harvesting on state or federal lands. No preference on how you come down on this, but do want to have a clear legislative intent on what is meant by who is going to be paying that tax and how that tiered rate structure would work. So those are my only two concerns I would raise in just in the context of how we would implement this. And I will stop there and thank you for the time.
Thank you for raising the issues with us, for alerting us. We appreciate your participation today. Now we will move to John Sweet, followed by David Bugney.
Chair Nathanson, committee members and staff, I'm John Sweet, Coos County Commissioner and Vice Chair of the AOC Natural Resource Steering Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My remarks are being submitted on behalf of Association Oregon Counties, whose Natural Resource Steering Committee and Legislative Committee both voted unanimously to oppose the proposed severance tax bills for two basic reasons. First, I'm well aware of the strong market for wood products. However, in spite of that, we think this is simply not the time to be adding a tax that could adversely impact the timber and wood products industry. Good markets come and go, tax levies do not. In much of rural Oregon, the timber industry provides the dominant source of family wage jobs, averaging $50,000 a year with full benefits, compared to tourism jobs, around $25,000 a year, seasonal, not many benefits. As important as additional revenues are to local governments, protecting family wage jobs is a higher priority. We cannot risk losing the timber industry. The only thing holding log prices back in check right now is the salvage logging of trees killed by last year's forest fires. Not only have timber landowners lost millions of dollars to fires, but the destruction of trees on lands and reforestation means reduced harvest levels in the future. Keep in mind that last year's fires were not a one-off happening. The industries have suffered a series of such losses. On top of fire losses, we continue to see federal and state lands taken out of the harvest base, making it ever more difficult for the timber or the wood products companies to have a sufficient base of raw material. It goes on. The industries are faced with absorbing the gross receipts tax enacted during last year's legislation and the private forest accord, a state brokered commitment among timber companies, environmental interests to work together to modify existing timberland management and harvest levels is underway. This is likely to add management costs and reduce harvest. We need to let this effort play out before adding yet another tax on forest lands. The second reason behind AOC's opposition to the proposed severance taxes is that we hold such taxes to be solely for the support of local taxing districts, not the state or special interests. It appears that the proponents of the proposed severance taxes view CREP revenues so created as found money. To local governments and taxing districts, this money is lost money. Money we once had, but were relieved of by state action when previous severance taxes were phased out. Tyler gave a pretty good rundown of the history of timber taxation in the state. I won't go through that again. I'm fine. I think you got the gist of our testimony. Thank you.
We did, and I know that there is someone else signed up from AOC. Thank you for being with us today. Next is David Bugney, followed by Michael Calhoun, and then Doug Graff after that.
Hi, Chair Nathanson. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, this is members of the committee. My name's Dave Bugney, and I live in Clackamas County. My wife and I are opposed to many of the aspects of House Bill 2379-6, but due to time limits, I'll just focus on two points. First one, to require only the Forest Stewardship Council's or FSC's certification for 1% reduction in the proposed severance tax. And the second point, the elimination of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, or OFRI. Briefly, we own and manage about 84 acres of forest land near Estacada. We're proud of our forest stewardship, and we were honored for our work in 2020 as the Clackamas County Farm Forestry Association's Woodland Farmer of the Year. And we're also awarded the ODFW ODF Fish and Wildlife Stewardship Award for forest lands last year and are certified by Oregon's affiliate of the American Tree Farm System, or ATFS. So the first point, this bill gives unjustified preference to landowners certified under the FSC without regard for other certification systems providing accreditation and third-party verified sustainability assurances in Oregon. So as I mentioned, we are certified under the Oregon Tree Farm System, which is a program of the American Forest Foundation and the largest third-party certification system for family forest owners in the world. There are over 1,300 landowners certified in the Oregon Tree Farm System, representing about 720,000 acres that, like us, manage for sustainable wood supplies, clean water, wildlife habitat, and recreation. A thorough management is required for these programs, and this is ours right here, just to give you an idea. This is not a trivial document. This extends out to 2050. I'll be 90 then, hopefully around to enjoy it. The second point is eliminating OFRI, I believe, is a knee-jerk reaction to the recent negative publicity about it. They produce informational documents, including these. We've got a number of them. Two of these on wildlife habitat, and probably their best one on understanding forest practice laws for the common man like ourselves. So instead of eliminating OFRI, we suggest waiting until Governor Brown's audit of them is completed, and then recommend any changes that should be implemented, and then just move on. And this is a commodity-based organization funded by those of us who pay the forest products harvest taxes, and it should remain and be modified as necessary. So thank you for your time, and if there's any questions, I'll be happy to take them.
Thank you for being with us. Next is Michael Calhoun, followed by Doug Graff, and then Ken Cummings.
Hi, everyone. Am I good to go?
Yep.
Cool. Again, my name is Michael Calhoun. I'm from Vernonia, Oregon, where I was born and raised. And I fully support the passage of HB 2379. It would really mean a lot to a rural community to have this kind of revenue. And I always find it interesting when spokesmen come on here and talk about the rural community, and I'm that dude you're talking about. And when you have a corporation like Weyerhaeuser, a multi-million-dollar entity that is simply not paying its fair share, that's all that we're asking, is that when you come to communities like Vernonia, you come to Columbia County, you extract our resources, you use log trucks that are destroying our county roads, that you simply pay to help for infrastructure. I serve on the Vernonia Public Works Committee. We do not have money to pay for simple amenities around our town. This would really mean a lot. In terms of eliminating OFRI, yes, absolutely. I do not want my tax dollars going towards funding a propaganda arm of the timber industry. And I'm really excited that our current lawmakers are finally making headway on this. It really means a lot. And I look forward to working with you all later on this issue. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for being with us. Appreciate the testimony. Next is Doug Graff.
Good afternoon. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reske, FAM, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief of Fire Protection for the Department of Forestry. We've provided written testimony, neutral, and I'll stay here within 2 minutes and just make a few highlights on that testimony. First and foremost, I want to be available to the legislature as it deliberates on a really important topic, which is large fire funding in the state of Oregon. And I think everybody understands that dynamic has changed over the last decade. So appreciate the attention to this matter. The testimony in large part is a technical assessment as the legislature deliberates on transitioning from Emergency Fire Cost Committee, Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, abolishing that and moving towards a wildfire management fund. And there's five topics that we bring to light in that testimony that I would just highlight. The first is relative to the The law as introduced did not contemplate continuing the insurance policy, and that was addressed in further dashes. The second highlight I would recognize is it does not, it removes 1.5 FTE within administration of that fund, which tracks lodge fire costs from initial lodge fire estimates to recoveries and processes the insurance management through that process. And then repeals three laws. One is the 477-277, which is the surcharge on improved lots, which was a legislative decision in recognition of lodge fire costs increasing in the wildland urban interface. Removes 477-771-D, which was largely known as the East Side Rate Relief. And with that, I would close, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for the testimony. Ken Cummings?
Yes.
And that will be followed by Brennan Geraltz.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kenneth Cummings, and I am chair of the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, which oversees the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on this policy bill. To be clear, I'm here representing landowners across Oregon in opposition to the bill because it dissolves the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, an incredible, vital component of protecting Oregonians through Oregon's complete and coordinated fire protection system. I'd like to highlight four areas very quickly, but before I do that, I'd remind the committee that we have over a half century of leadership experience in providing governance related to fire policy, procuring firefighting expense insurance, reporting initial fire estimates, insurance claim processing through reconciliation, auditing of emergency fire costs, and most recently making strategic investments in the complete and coordinated fire system. First area is about public-private partnerships. This committee is made up of four volunteer members that represent forest landowners statewide. And after such a devastating 2020 fire season, now more than ever, it's critical to strengthen, not abolish, this public-private partnership. The highest value that we bring to this is one, involvement in, and two, accountability for governance over multiple fire cost processes, providing, if you will, a third-party integrity. It ultimately protects the general fund. The second area is the insurance policy. You're aware that we have one of a kind policy in the world. And over the last 40 years, the history of that policy with underwriters have paid out more than $20 million than we have paid in premiums. If insurance were to be part of an overall plan and strategy for the future, the passage of this bill will certainly affect the possibility of even having insurance at all. And the third area is strategic investments. In the last 5 years, please read my written comments. I urge you to wait till this funding study is done. 4304.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings, for your testimony, but I do want to state for the public record that you were signed up with a position of neutral.
I'm sorry, that was a mistake.
Next is Brennan Geraltz, followed by Jennifer Beath.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brennan Geraltz, and I'm a vice president of the board of directors of Douglas Forest Protective Association. DFPA is responsible for providing wildfire prevention, detection, and suppression on over 1.6 million acres of private, county, state, BLM, and tribal lands. The DFPA Board of Directors strongly opposes House Bill 2379, including -6 amendment, for three primary reasons found in Section 14 of the bill. Repealing the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund places the burden of large fire costs exclusively on those who harvest timber, instead of the equitable shared fiscal responsibility between all landowners we have today. Elimination of the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, as Mr. Cummings noted prior, and repealing ORS 321.011.0 0.012 from the Oregon statute eliminates the state's fundamental priority to put out wildfires and eliminates the public's shared responsibility in funding fire suppression. Currently, all non-federal forest land owners pay into the OFLPF through a mix of harvest taxes, acreage assessments, and structural surcharges. This is a fiscally equitable recognition that all forest landowners are at risk of wildfire, regardless of management regime. This bill would change that to a punitive system only funded by those who actively manage their forest land. This idea is not only completely inequitable, but short-sighted as well. Oregon's legislature has a proud history of promoting public-private partnerships, recognizing that these partnerships provide benefits to all parties involved and exceed what any of the parties can do or accomplish on their own. By dissolving the EFCC, House Bill 2379 destroys a multi-party public-private partnership in existence since 1930 between landowners, ODF, the General Fund, and the Lloyd's of London Insurance Syndicate. Today, the EFCC provides policy and oversight that functions as a fire suppression cost auditing mechanism for the state. Finally, the bill eliminates ORS 321, as I mentioned, 0.011 and 0.012. This is literally the policy and statute that prioritizes putting fires out to protect lives, communities, and our natural resources. The second recognizes that because the public shares in the responsibility of starting most fires in Oregon, which on average is 70% of fires are human started, the public would also share in the responsibility of putting them out. To conclude, this bill drives Oregon away from a hugely successful public-private partnership and into a misguided failure of increased loss and cost due to wildfire. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for being with us and for your testimony. Next is Jennifer Beath.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Beath and I'm with Starker Forest based in Corrales. Starker Forest opposes House Bill 2379 and any adjustments to the current funding, mission, and organization of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. Starker Forest is an 85-year-old, fifth-generation, family-owned forest land owner that is committed to the sustainable management of forest lands. House Bill 2379 defunds OFRI. In the same way that over 20 other Oregon commodity commissions serve their growers through a self-imposed tax or assessment, OFRI serves the entire forest sector by educating landowners, forest workers, and the public about all things related to forests in Oregon. OFRI's materials, tours, meetings, and conferences include information on management of all forests, private and public, east side and west side. As you know, OFRI receives no general fund dollars. Just a few weeks ago, a Lincoln County commissioner told me that she thinks that industries have a right to tax themselves to educate the public about what they do. That's what OFRI does, and it fulfills its mission in the same ways that any other commodity commission or checkoff program would. Starker Forest offers forest education field trips to elementary school students in Lincoln, Benton, and Linn counties. The forest is a fantastic classroom, and OFRI's bus reimbursement program brings equity to low-income elementary schools throughout Oregon by providing forest access to all schools and teachers. OFRI's materials correlate with statewide learning standards throughout all levels of K-12. The Oregon Department of Education is a partner with OFRI, and the important high school forestry and natural resources curriculum, where career and technical education provides not only higher graduation rates, but provides high schoolers with academic and technical skills, knowledge, and training necessary to succeed in future careers and to become lifelong learners. Last, as a parent of elementary school-aged children, I've observed the OFRI-sponsored Talk About Trees program. My children and 300 of their schoolmates have learned about cones, paper making, trees, wood products, and forests at four different grade levels. These short but repeated experiences make lasting impressions about the wonders and beauty of Oregon's forests. The forest product sector in Oregon works as a family unit. From planting trees to milling logs, providing the state of Oregon with benefits such as employment for 60,000 workers, important wood products needed for housing, recreation, clean water, and wildlife habitat, As our grower-supported commodity commission, OFRI serves us well, and we oppose any effort to change the structure or funding of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you for being with us for the testimony. Next is Catherine, and on the sign-up sheet, it looks like Tassin, but I believe it's Thomason. I'm guessing at that. After Catherine is Jim Lockhart, followed by Tyler Jansen. Catherine, please. Well, we'll see if we can catch up with Catherine later. Jim Lockhart, are you ready?
I'm working on it here.
Oh, we can hear you. Why don't you go right ahead?
All right, good deal. Well, thank you, Chair and the committee, for the opportunity to speak. I'm speaking for Forest Web, writing on behalf of 11,000 supporters. We believe that HB 2379 is a step in the right direction with the goal of achieving a higher level of self-sufficiency in the face of catastrophic wildfires, especially since Oregon may not always have access to fire insurance. The bill is well thought out in that it ties the tax to the market value rather than to the volume of timber taken. It also takes a large step towards ensuring the corporations in the timber industry are subject to paying taxes and providing revenue to the state of Oregon, as everyone else must do. However, there are elements of this bill that are of concern and need to be reviewed and revised. We address them. We are concerned that the amount of 5% set for industrial timber companies in this bill. Oregon original forest fee and yield tax was 12.5%, and the harvest tax in the 1970s and 1980s was 6.5. After last year's devastating fires, the demand on our diminished supply of timber is soaring, and a 5% tax does not seem adequate given the value of timber in a worldwide market. Also, small timber lot owners are already paying a 5% tax, and it is not equitable that large companies making much larger profits should not pay a higher rate. Though this bill does not directly exclude taxing harvests on public lands, it also does not overly include them. In Washington and California, harvest tax apply to the money raised from logs invested on public lands. I'll skip ahead because I'm sure this list will go over. The bill encourages afforestation is flawed, creating a potentially onerous and expensive process that does little to encourage people to grow trees on vacant land. Also, the bill does not give tax incentives for longer harvest rotations. Longer rotations decrease the frequency of logging's negative impacts, such as soil compaction, soil erosion, siltation of creeks, rivers, and reservoirs, and the use of post-logging chemicals, such as pesticides and herbicides, that drift or wash to our farms or our waterways. Another concern we have involves taking OFRI's funds, along with 10% of future severance tax, and allocating to Oregon State University's newly created Forest Research and Experiment account with little oversight details as to how the fund is to be utilized and monitored. This does not address the need for timber industry to pay its fair share, as well as improve Oregon's ability to cope with future catastrophic wildfires. Unfortunately, the bill needs serious revision before Forest Web can recommend the passage of this bill. Perfect timing. Thank you for your time and consideration.
And another reminder for you and everyone else, we're happy to receive written testimony until tomorrow.
I believe that's already been submitted.
Good. And now, to try to fit in at least a few more people before we need to end for the day, I'd like to ask everybody to limit their comments to 2 minutes each. I think we can still get through several more people at 2 minutes each. Next is Tyler Jansen, followed by Kate McMichael.
Thank you. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Tyler Jansen. I handle the revenue portfolio at the Association of Oregon Counties. I don't want to go over what you've heard from Commissioner Sweet. He did a great job of outlining why we're opposed to this particular bill. But if I may, I'd like to leave you with a different top line message from AOC. We would like to have a longer legislature-sanctioned conversation regarding severance tax. Again, we want to have a longer conversation. As most of you know, counties historically received 100% of the severance tax. This bill would purport to give us 30%. It's a very complicated issue. Our counties feel differently about it. However, we want to be able to have the conversation over a longer period of time so that we're not stuck repeating this pattern of being reactive to every measure that comes out. I applaud Rep. Holby for bringing this forward for 8 years, but it seems to me we're having the same conversation every single year. If we could talk about this over the interim in a sanction table that has ourselves, that has you, has industry at the table, and the other stakeholders, that would be appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next is Kate McMichael, followed by Todd Payne, then Jody Weiser.
Hopefully you hear me.
I hear you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Chair Nathanson and members of the House Committee on Revenue, thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Kate McMichael, and my wife and I live in Eastern Lane County. Our forest property was burned in the Holiday Farm fire. Although there are multiple reasons we oppose HB 2379 in all its incarnations, I'll speak on only two this afternoon. Current Oregon policy per statutes 321.011 and 012, we just heard about this, is for the public to share in the cost of suppressing wildfires because forests benefit all Oregonians and fires do not. HB 2379 repeals these statutes. We did not cause the wildfire that burned our property. The vast majority of fires in Oregon are caused by the general public, or in the case of ours, a public utility, or by lightning, not by forest landowners or forestry operators. Woodland owners already pay into funds for structure fires and wildland fires. It does not make sense to remove the public responsibility to share in the cost of wildfire suppression while shifting the burden of paying those costs to the very people who already suffer the greatest loss, woodland owners. I invite you to come and walk on our property and see what it looks like post-fire. Secondly, we strongly oppose taxing the value of harvested timber rather than the volume. The value tax is particularly onerous for small woodland owners like us, whose logging costs are typically higher since there is less economy of scale. And of course, we still have to pay property taxes on our burned forest, as well as state and federal tax on any income we receive from selling our timber. We've already begun replanting. As we look to the future, a tax on value will encourage us to grow our timber on a shorter rotation with an early clear cut. We would really prefer to consider a longer rotation that includes periodic thinning for all the benefits an older forest provides. However, the much higher costs associated with the value tax could easily make such responsible, sustainable forest management too expensive for us. So for these two reasons, maintaining. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for being with us. And if you have anything in writing, please send it in.
It's there.
Great. It's there. Thank you. Todd Payne, followed by Jody Weiser.
Can you hear me okay, Chair Nathanson?
Yes. Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Reschke, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Todd Payne, and I'm the CEO of the Seneca Family of Companies and the Chairman of the Board for the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. Seneca employs 470, manages 170,000 acres of forest land in seven counties, and operates four sawmills and a state-of-the-art wood-fired cogeneration facility that provides clean, renewable energy to 13,000 homes in Eugene. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in opposition to House Bill 2379. This bill would be an 800% increase in taxes on harvested timber paid by Oregon's 65,000 private forest landowners who just suffered the worst wildfire season in recent history. This bill effectively doubles the tax burden on an industry that already pays 1.5 times more than other business sectors in the state. This is on top of the 41% increased tax burden on business the Oregon legislature has passed over the last few years. Seneca has survived through smart innovation and experienced risk calculations. Long-term stability is important. we operate in a boom and bust commodity market, the temporary increase we are seeing in lumber prices driven by homeowner remodeling demands during stay-at-home orders does not mean the whole supply chain benefits. Taxes are permanent. Blips in short-run markets are not. What goes up must come down, and often the low is lower than the high. Unlike farmers who harvest their crop annually, we invest in cultivating seedlings for 40-plus years before we see a return, provided those trees aren't lost to fire, insects, disease, snow, or ice. Because of that, we see things in a long-term lens. In the coming years, our mills will undeniably face a shortage in timber supply from three things. One, hundreds of thousands of burned acres harvested before schedule due to the Labor Day fires. Two, reductions in harvest on state forests from their proposed habitat conservation plan. And three, other regulatory changes in the works. I urge you to maintain a focus on restoring hundreds of thousands of acres of burned forests back to healthy, thriving forests that are less likely to burn. Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee.
Thank you for being with us and for the testimony. Jody Weiser, followed by Dan Connolly. And if we go a few minutes longer after that, I think Catherine has joined us. We'll try for that. Jody Weiser.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here today speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. There are many elements of House Bill 2379 that deserve your vote. It reinstates a severance tax on timber that has been missing for nearly 20 years, and does so based on value and at a rate competitive with that of our neighbor to the north, which has forest land most similar to our own. It does so while also addressing a number of other timber tax issues that have been vexing for some time, and it consolidates the reinstated tax with the harvest tax. When legislators ended this tax, they removed a significant source of funding for counties, and they deserve to have that revenue back. But the state has also lost timber revenue because so much of the industry is now organized in structures to avoid corporate income tax, including REITs, TIMOs, and pass-throughs. And because many owners don't live in Oregon, we are no longer receiving either corporate income tax or personal income taxes on most of the profits from this industry. The state needs that missing revenue. This bill, therefore, would use the revenue generated by reinstituting a robust Oregon severance tax to address local needs, state needs, and services funded with our current harvest tax. I can't emphasize enough the significance of taxing based on value rather than board fee. Obviously, harvests that produce prime Western red cedar or Douglas fir lumber should pay more than harvests of low value black cottonwood. Since we now receive little income tax based on industry profits, this is the only way left to make our tax system more equitable. It would also be more productive. The bill's lower tax rates for smaller landowners recognizes the economies of scale that are a reality. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Dan Connolly.
I was prepared for
Ms. Weiser, would you please turn off your camera and microphone?
Yes.
Thank you. Dan Connolly, are you still with us? I'll wait just a few more seconds. Catherine, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Please begin.
Thank you. Chair Nathanson and members of the Revenue Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Catherine Thomason, and I am speaking on behalf of the Environmental Caucus of the Democratic Party of Oregon and in favor of the severance tax. Forests make up 50% of our land base. They're our legacy, produce wood products, along with our water, define our ecosystems and iconic salmon, and store the most carbon of any forest in the world. Why should we reinstitute a severance tax in Oregon? Well, first and foremost, our counties deserve revenue from the lands that have had their property tax assessed based only on the land and not on the trees. Returning this revenue to their general fund helps them provide for the needs of their county. It reinstitutes the severance tax, which has been missing for 20 years, and does so based on value and a rate competitive with Washington State. Frankly, the value of timber is unlikely to go down due to increased demand and the reduced amount of lands that can be harvested. Likewise, our communities across the state deserve to have dedicated funding in adequate amounts for forest fire preparedness to protect our communities and fire management. This bill will result as well in taxation on federal harvests that are purchased by large timber companies and comprise 9% of all timber harvested in the state. Personally, and on behalf of the small owners, I would like to encourage a more graduated tax than the current Dash 6 amendment. The natural cutoff of 2,500 acres for the highest rate of 5% should be instituted, but a lower rate for those smaller. Lastly, a better incentive with a marked reduction in the tax for those who follow forest stewardship certification.
Ms. Thomason,
it will really help. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. We're going to take just one more speaker this afternoon. Kevin Campbell, are you with us?
I am. Good afternoon, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell, and I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Oregon Loggers. AOL represents nearly 1,000 small family forest businesses across the state with more than 22,000 employees who provide the renewable wood products that Americans use every day. Thanks for the opportunity to share our professional forestry perspective and our opposition to House Bill 2379 and the Dash 6 Amendment. We believe this bill would harm the small businesses and working families across Oregon that do the work of forestry. I'll avoid duplicating testimony that was already provided, and I'm going to try to focus just on three brief concerns. First, the tax proposed in the bill is based on volatile pond values and gross revenue without recognition of the cost to do sustainable and environmentally responsible forest management. AOL's members who move wood products from forests to market complete this work on a contracted basis at rates with very narrow margins. This proposed tax change would further reduce the capital available for contracting with these small businesses. Second, it's significant that this tax is levied on timber from all ownerships. Increasing the cost to do this work will make it less economically viable to achieve the recommendations of the Governor's Wildfire Council, address fire resiliency, tackle community safety and defensible space needs, and get cost prohibitive work in Eastern Oregon accomplished. Third, AOL is concerned that the measure identifies just one of the three forest certification systems to receive a tax reduction when they are all recognized as valid. From an operator's perspective, all lands are treated with respect and high quality work is a top priority regardless of the ownership of the land or the certification system in place. As you know, Oregon's existing forestry laws through the Oregon Forest Practices Act are rigorous. In closing, it's impossible to separate small business and large business in the forest sector. We believe House Bill 2379 would disproportionately impact small businesses and working families. Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Anyone who's not on the committee would have their microphone and camera off now. We don't have time to hear everybody else who was signed up for testimony. We have, I believe, five more people who are signed up who we didn't get to this afternoon. I'm sorry that I can't continue the meeting because this room needs to be, even a virtual room, needs to be used for another committee that begins in just a little while. So anybody who is already signed up for testimony today and we weren't able to get to you, you are welcome to join us at our very next meeting. Staff can provide you with the information for how to make sure that you are signed up and have a link to connect with us for our next meeting. So with that, my intent, before I close is I will announce the public hearing for today is closed. It's being held over, though, to our next meeting. Mr. Alanak, can you confirm that our next meeting is Monday?
Yes, Madam Chair. It is Monday at 3:15.
Thank you. So, everybody who would still like to testify because you have some points that need to be made that haven't already been covered, you are welcome to join us at our next meeting. I am holding over this public hearing on House Bill 2379. We'll get to this again at our next meeting. Committee members, if you have questions you've been collecting or issues that have been raised for you, I welcome you to raise those questions or points at our next meeting so that we can hear them and ask Legislative Revenue Office to collect answers or observations for us. Is there any other business before us before we adjourn today? Mr. Alanak, committee members, any final thoughts or business before I adjourn? I'll wait just a few seconds to see if a hand goes up. Thank you all very much for your patience and your courtesies today. I'll see you at the next meeting. We're adjourned.